Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to an iPad, iPod, you know, any type of device, computer, and hit play. Today we have a real interesting show on the recent Supreme Court decision, which came down less than 24 hours ago, the U.S. v. Jones case. My introduction for the show, though, is a shout-out to lawyers with expertise in a particular area that you're more than welcome to contact me about cases that you'd like to do shows on because they have implications for electronic discovery or information governance. I win because the shows are much easier for me to come up with. The audience wins because an expert in the area shares insights into a case, right after, the case has come down, ideally. And the expert wins because, it's easier to talk about a case that came down than to find the time to blog about it. I've actually recognized that firsthand as at the beginning of the year I launched my own blog site, docreviewmd.com, and I have 6 posts already, but I have 6 more half-written, so my blogging is going to be restricted to document review and predictive coding topics and issues, and just to add, my tweeting is even less, but I expect to continue doing more tweeting, just not in a fashion that makes people wonder if I have any friends or a life, and to answer those questions for you, the answers are yes and no. My tweet handle, by the way, is @review_less. So now about today's show. We got this decision from the Supreme Court that actually addressed the privacy issues and technology somewhat head-on, which was interesting. And although I've had minimal time to prepare for the show, our guest has been waiting patiently for this decision to come down. And in fact, we agreed to do this show several months ago. So our guest, Edward McNicholas, is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of the international law firm Sidley Austin and global coordinator of its privacy, data security, and information law practice. This practice focuses on clients facing complex information technology, constitutional and privacy issues, and civil and white-collar criminal matters. Ed concentrates his practice on trial and appellate representations of technology-sophisticated clients, including telecommunication carriers, electronic service providers, financial services companies, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and other companies facing complex personal information issues. He's also an experienced counselor, public policy advocate, and internal investigator. And Ed has done a couple of these shows with us before, and they've gone well. So, Ed, glad to have you back on the show.
Pleasure to be back on the show with you.
Okay, so let's start the show. This case came down yesterday, and many of us haven't read the facts about the case except for what the national news media has reported. So what were the key facts in the case and its main issue?
Well, the key facts in the case are pretty straightforward, although I'll point out 2 ways in which some of the press reports are a little bit misleading on this. The headline you're seeing is that this was a case about warrantless placement of a GPS device on a person's car. And that's close to what the actual facts are. The actual facts involve a guy named Antoine Jones, who was a nightclub owner in the District of Columbia. And through various activities, police became suspicious of him that he was running a drug ring. And they wanted to start tracking him to see. And this is the first fact is that they actually went and got a warrant to put the GPS device on his car. Interesting also is that it wasn't his car, it was his wife's car. And you might think that was a kind of a minor issue, his car, wife's car, what's the problem? Except for the fact that the majority of the Supreme Court then analyzes this as a property rights case and bases the privacy expectations we're going to talk about in a couple minutes on the idea of property rights. And so it was his wife's car and that he was merely a bailee of the car is significant. But nonetheless, they do get the warrant to put the tracking device on the car, and they have a warrant that expires for 10 days to put the warrant on there in the District of Columbia. Well, they don't do it in the District of Columbia. They do it in Maryland, which is not that far off because it's just right over the border here in D.C. But they put it on the 11th day in Maryland. And so the warrant had expired. Now, the interesting thing is that they had a 10-day warrant, but then they tracked the vehicle for nearly a month. And so I don't know what the police were thinking. Maybe they thought, well, they've talked to a judge and it was all cleared up and everything else was technical. But they had a 10-day warrant. They surveilled for a month. They surveilled in the wrong jurisdiction. Apparently, there was some sloppy police work there. They did, however, find that he was a drug dealer. A multiple count indictment was issued against him. Jury returned a guilty verdict, and he was sentenced to life in prison. So this is not a small case or a case involving a particularly sympathetic victim. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, though, threw out the conviction because they believed that the police had violated his privacy rights. And yesterday, the unanimous Supreme Court affirmed the D.C. Circuit, throwing out the conviction.
Interesting. You know, it's sort of funny when you talk about things the police can do or do. I had the fortune a few weeks ago to help out a neighbor whose kids were at their ski condo and they weren't there. And when I say kids, they were, you know, of an age close to adulthood. And mischief occurred and the police came and there was a standoff at their door for about an hour. As the crime investigation units were being brought in, and I went over there at 5 a.m. and was told, you know, they're waiting for a lawyer, and I said, well, that's actually me, and went in and talked to my clients, you know, and they said, well, can the police come in, you know, and I said, I took constitutional law and criminal law back in 1993. but I can tell you the police generally can, you know, do things, you know, they do. And, you know, they say they have witnesses and I think they're coming in. So why don't we resolve this? And we did. And anyway, it's a separate story, but it's interesting, you know, how these, you know, these issues can be very real, when you think that they're not going to be.
Well, and one thing here is that the GPS units, they've been around for a while, but they used to be very fancy units where they were expensive units. And they would only use them in very significant drug crime cases, murder cases. But part of what's driving this case here is that these units have become very cheap. Police departments who are, you know, well-funded will have many, many of these units. They can throw them on their cars very quickly and track people pervasively. And so I think part of what's going on here is the concern that the police thought that they, at least some departments thought that, well, we don't really need a warrant for these things, and they're really cheap. And the specter became started developing that police were going to be able to use these things pervasively without getting a warrant. And so that's I think the actual police practice here was driving some of the animus behind this case getting the attention that it has.
And I have relatives who are police officers who are tech at Adept, and they've been using their smartphones doing creative things that the other officers have said, hey, that's pretty cool. So, you know, I see those types of things happening more and more. First of all, did the government get killed in this decision? Because they lost. What's your take on this?
This is an interesting case because if you have a simple idea, the Supreme Court of you've got conservative justices and liberal justices, and the conservative justices will always support law enforcement. This case confuses those ideas. You've got Justice Scalia, not exactly a noted liberal, writing for the majority, saying that the police had exceeded the bounds of privacy, and then Justice Alito, writing for 4 justices, agreeing with that. So you've got all 9 justices saying the government has overstepped. So I don't know if I'd say the government got killed, but this was a significant line in the sand being drawn about the Fourth Amendment, that these new technologies cannot just be deployed without reference to the historical notions of Fourth Amendment freedoms. So even if you can do it with technology, it doesn't mean that it's going to pass Fourth Amendment muster.
So what happened? Did the judges get iPods and iPhones this year for the holidays? I'm wondering, because we had Quan came down the year before, and everyone was expecting some type of a holding that involved technology, and they sidestepped the issue here. But here, you know, everyone seems to be coming on board with that there is an issue. It's just sort of interesting.
Well, Justice Scalia's opinion was not exactly based on a technology forward approach to this. Justice Scalia, writing for the majority, and we should talk about who's in that majority because it's interesting, but let me describe what Justice Scalia did. He actually stepped back into common law notions of trespass to get to his notion of the Fourth Amendment. And so we've talked about, I think, on this show, but people have heard about the idea of expectations of privacy. And that came out of a case called Katz, which was the case that said you could not tap a wire, could not put a wiretap on a public payphone without getting a court order. And that whole notion of expectations of privacy and reasonable expectations of privacy has been one of the most pervasive ideas in this area. Justice Scalia stepped back behind that and said, before you had notions of expectation of privacy, you had notions of property and common law trespass, and that notions of common law trespass and property rights are a more fundamental way of looking at privacy. He didn't say, and the majority did not say, that that's the only way of looking at it, but he said that that way is the most basic way, and that more basic way of looking at it did not change after Katz. So you have a privacy interest that arises out of your property, and a privacy interest that can arise out of reasonable expectations. And Justice Scalia said, we don't need to worry about whether there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in someone's movements, which is what most of the briefing was about. Justice Scalia took the majority down the road of saying that we can decide it on a narrow ground here. And the narrow ground here is that there was a property interest, and the property interest was violated when the police put the unit on the car. Which is one of the main ways people thought this case was going to come out. Justice Alito, writing for the four justices, did the expectation of privacy analysis that a lot of people were expecting the court to do.
Huh. Interesting. Does this case answer the question of whether the search caused by installing a GPS device requires a warrant?
It does. I mean, that's one thing about Justice Scalia's analysis, is it does lead to a pretty bright-line rule that there is a physical trespass to property. And if the police need to put a physically trespass, actually touch the car, in order to put this unit on there, then they need to get a warrant. Now, the interesting thing is that as we're talking, there are police departments out there saying, well, we've got in lower Manhattan, we've got video cameras over most of the city. In a lot of cities, London, other major
Pittsburgh.
Cities, Pittsburgh, have cameras all over the business center. And if you take those cameras and put those feeds together and then have the ability to look at license plates, well, you're just kind of racing your artificial intelligence that you may well be able to create a database of every car moving around the central business district in a not-so-distant future. And so the idea that, well, we have to put a physical device on a car, that may be a very limited technology in a certain way. So we might be able to get beyond that very quickly. And Justice Scalia's opinion doesn't speak to that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I see the IBM commercials that everyone else does, where they go through these incredible fact patterns and Watson's there in the background, basically, and they're like, yeah, I work for IBM. I solve these types of problems. I think the only thing holding us back there is I don't think the government, local governments can afford IBM to come in and do the data analytics. But certainly those issues are out there.
One thing that Justice Scalia, I want to mention that he did not get into, was there was a question also of even if they there's a question of whether there was a reasonable search under the circumstances, even though it was warrantless. And so sometimes you can have a search that's reasonable. Let's say you were, something was evolving very quickly, and you didn't have time to get a warrant. And so there can be reasonable
crime
search.
Exception. You saw something in process, you slap a GPS, although, you know, you draw your gun, you draw your GPS.
Exactly. You can have things that are just evolving too quickly. So, and Justice Scalia gets to that part of the opinion and says, government did not raise that below. They forfeited the argument. We're not opining on it. And so the majority leaves open the question about whether, in certain circumstances, it would be reasonable to have a GPS device attached without a warrant. And so by saying the government didn't argue and we're not getting to that, he leaves that open. And it might be significant that what he doesn't say, because he got Justice Sotomayor to join in to make him the majority opinion as opposed to Justice Alito's opinion. And there's a lot of debate because Justice Sotomayor's opinion, who wrote a separate concurrence, is far-reaching. She would go back. I mean, if you think Justice Scalia went back to common law norms,
mm-hmm.
Justice Sotomayor would go back and revisit the whole third-party doctrine. The third-party doctrine is the idea that once you give your information to a third party for constitutional purposes, you've lost your expectation of privacy in that. So that once I give once I give my bank information to my bank on a constitutional level, I've lost a privacy interest in that. Or my calling records, I've lost a privacy interest in that because the phone company has that. And because of that third party doctrine, that's why we have statutes coming in, like ECPA, like Right to Financial Privacy Act, Fair Credit Reporting Act. We have these statutes coming in and setting a statutory expectation of privacy when there is no constitutional expectation of privacy. Justice Sotomayor would go back and revisit that. And if he took out the third-party doctrine, you would make what it is an area right now driven by statutes into an area driven by constitutional law, which would really change things. Right now, there's a great also fluidity between the civil expectation of privacy and the criminal expectation of privacy. It's not exact. There are some cases about overflying planes and such where the civil and criminal expectation of privacy differ. But that could also be another way of solving this. But Justice Sotomayor's analysis was radical in the sense of going to the root of the issue. And then she joins Justice Scalia's opinion. And it might be that she joined the majority opinion in order to get Justice Scalia to edit the opinion and not say some things that she didn't want said by a majority. And so she may have been using her vote in order to further hear her more pervasive view. And so that it's interesting that Justice Scalia, when he gets to reasonableness, just says it wasn't raised below and we're not talking about it.
You know, maybe the fact that this was a majority decision, lines blur, because it wasn't as if you were changing the outcome dramatically, and it just turned into a big game of poker.
Well, there may have been some very interesting discussions at the court, and in a few decades, maybe we'll find out what those discussions were. But for right now, it's all speculation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of speculation right now about why Justice Sotomayor joined the more limited opinion of Justice Scalia as opposed to the more expansive opinion of Justice Alito, which talked about expectations of privacy and how expectations of privacy have evolved, need to keep pace with technology, and the kind of things that you would think the justices would be talking about, as opposed to talking about common law trespass, like Justice Scalia was talking about.
Interesting. Can we draw any conclusions on the court's posturing on technology? Are there any shifts going on that are in recognition that we are in a digital age, or are we looking back to old property law?
Well, I think this decision is very significant in that it offers a glimpse of how the court may look at the privacy cases that we're going to see coming over the next several years. So you had a majority. We've got basically, to my mind, you've got four justices. The I'll say the traditional conservative justices are what people would view as conservative justices: Justice Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and Roberts, who were uncomfortable with this and want some restrictions on police activities where there's or just potential for Orwellian pervasive privacy. Now, they went back to this idea of property, which would lead to greater protections for privacy in the home. Then you have four justices, Alito, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, who want to adapt the Fourth Amendment more towards current expectations of privacy and would, on a case-by-case basis, talk about how the expectations of privacy have evolved for that particular technology in those particular circumstances. And then Justice Sotomayor wants to really step back and maybe talk about a much broader sense of privacy going forward. And so you've got all nine justices who are concerned about privacy issues, who have clearly articulated those concerns. But you've got at least three rationales, and I suspect there's probably four or five different theories on the court on these issues. And so when you've got that number of justices who are interested in an issue and who have different lines of jurisprudence to develop, you wind up getting a lot more cases granted in an area. You see this in the religion cases where you get a good religion case, it's very likely to be granted. And I think we're going to see that in privacy. When you have a good privacy case come up to the court, it's going to be more likely to be granted. And so we're going to wind up with a lot more of these cases coming out. But this is a very significant case in and of itself.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, at Georgetown this year, there were a number of there always are outstanding panels. I always enjoy going to that particular program because the quality of the speakers. But even though I'm all about search and retrieval and using more machine assisted review, and there were some great panels on that. The best panel to me was the one on privacy. And I think everyone felt that way because it just grabs you. It's a topic that grabs everyone. and there's so many, boundaries that are being blurred right now. I agree with you. The courts are going to be struggling with this. Do you see any issues looming out there that are close to being grappled with, or we're going to have to wait for the next slate of cases coming down?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how Congress responds to this decision. Justice Alito's opinion notes that these sorts of things would not come up to the court on a constitutional basis if the Congress had spoken directly to them. And one would think that if there's a role for part of government that's supposed to read how people's perceptions of privacy are changing and their comfort levels with different technologies in a pretty finely granulated way, that Congress would be the better branch of government than having nine justices do this on a constitutional basis. And Justice Alito comes very close to asking Congress to please, will you address these sorts of technologies because you can develop a much more robust record, understand how much is actually being deployed, and it doesn't come up in the context of a case. And also here, I mean, the net result is that Antoine Jones, who was indicted and convicted of being a drug dealer and a not insignificant drug dealer, has his conviction overturned. So if Congress were able to look at this going forward, that would be a simpler thing. So ECPA reform is an issue that was going to come forward a lot on Congress. And we're going to see a lot more questions coming up on ECPA. Locational privacy generally is an issue that I think we're going to see some involvement with it. People are waking up to the idea that cell phones are a tracking device. And, of course, cell phones have to know where you are because how you can make a phone call on them. And they know it's your phone number. So it obviously it's inherent in the technology that it is it has to be able to track you. And the implications of that for commerce, for law enforcement, for national security, for knowing where your loved ones are just really coming into people's minds. And so I think those issues will be worked out both. Hopefully they'll be worked out in Congress. And if Congress can't act on these issues, then you'll wind up seeing them in the court again.
Yeah, I don't know which is a more representative sample of technology experts. You know, the Supreme Court with the elder judges, or Congress. You know, Congressman Wiener aside, you know, I'm not sure how many experts we have there. But anyway,
I do think the justices at least, some of them are a bit older than the average, but they do have. New clerks coming in every year, and I think the clerks play a very, very, very valuable role.
Very good point.
You know, in terms of helping the justices understand these technologies.
Well, the last question, since we just talked about doing this podcast in the last, you know, literally 15 hours, I'm not sure if you've given thought to, but you're an e-discovery lawyer as well, and you almost have to be in this area. You know, looking broadly or narrowly, whatever you want, what do you see as the big issue right now in e-discovery on January 24th, 2012? So you really have the full range of issues to aim at.
I would think employee expectation of privacy.
Okay.
Because we're seeing people walk around with personal devices and they're taking them in and out of work. People are working 24/7 and being available 24/7 to their employers. And so the idea that you have your work device and your home phone and your work phone, it's an idea that has gone by the wayside. You see very few people walking around with two cell phones anymore. People walk around with one cell phone, and it's got their personal calls on it and their work calls on it. Their iPad is likewise combined. And if you have an approach like Justice Alito took for four justices, and I think probably Justice Sotomayor would be sympathetic to this too, and that might be his fifth vote, you could see where expectations of privacy might well develop in this area. And so if you have employees developing expectations of privacy, then the idea that the IT department can simply turn on the servers at 3 o'clock in the morning and make a complete copy of everything, and then you run your analysis on the copy of everything, might not work. You might have to go employee by employee and get consent or get some limits. Or employees might be able to say, you know, I'm going to have a folder marked personal, and that is going to be presumptively out of the e-discovery search. And this could, complicate things a lot for e-discovery.
Cloud, it's the privacy rights.
Privacy rights.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and your reference to the cloud. I don't mean to diminish the idea that employees are putting stuff up in the cloud. Companies are putting stuff up in the cloud. The dispersion of information across not just a corporate network, but onto other people's networks, and what challenge that poses for e-discovery is pretty phenomenal. Because when you've got you're walking around with your iPad, and you've got you sent yourself the key documents that you're working on are sitting on your iPad, and you know corporate security is a hassle, so you've just sent it to the word processor, and then you back it up to iCloud, you could easily wind up with very interesting iterations of documents that people don't even realize exist sitting on a server at Amazon or Apple or Google, and how your e-discovery plan contemplates taking care of those documents is a real challenge for everyone working in this field right now.
Yep. Yeah, it goes back to the article I wrote about partnering with technologists. This is a thorny one. It's going to take some discussions between technologists and lawyers to figure out, you know, what the risks are, really. iCloud's sort of new, but you're right. I mean, these are issues that are going to come up, no doubt. Well, that means there are plenty more shows to do and lots of work for you, Ed, so that's great. You picked a good area of law to be in here.
Certainly interesting.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us here at ESI Bytes on short notice. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later in the year. And I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Chernov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.